Ennio Morricone's theme of Ali from the Battle of Algiers. Morricone passed away today at the age of 91. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Egypt, where coronavirus infections are continuing to rise, threatening to overwhelm the healthcare system. As the government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi grapples with the pandemic, it's cracked down, arresting doctors, journalists, lawyers who dare to speak out. Today, we take a look at one family who's been particularly targeted, arguably the most prominent activist family in Egypt. But first, we go to Cairo to speak with Democracy Now! Correspondent Sherif Abdelkaddous about the coronavirus crackdown, it being used as a pretext for arrests, to talk about the interview that he did. Hi, Sherif. Talk about what's happening right now in Egypt.
Well, Amy, as you mentioned, over the past few months, as the coronavirus has spread in Egypt, the state's been trying even more viciously than usual to control the message and to clamp down on any real or even perceived opposition. So, as you mentioned, dozens of people have been arbitrarily arrested, including at least 10 doctors who are being increasingly targeted, six journalists, lawyers, activists, and so on. And also, as the country went into a partial lockdown in March, the Ministry of Interior suspended all prison visitations for the families of detainees. So prisoners have largely been cut off from their families for the last 4 months. And unlike nearly every other country in the Middle East, Egypt has not released thousands of prisoners as a precaution against the coronavirus. Instead, it's arrested more people and cut off communication. Among the leading voices for prisoner rights in Egypt is the Saif family. The eldest son, Ali Abdel Fattah, was a leading figure of the 2011 revolution. He was released from prison last year after serving a 5-year sentence on trumped-up charges. During his brief time out, he had an additional 5 years of probation where he had to submit himself to a police station for 12 hours every day from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. He was rearrested in September, and he remains behind bars in pretrial detention. Now, Ali's mother, Leila Swaif, and his two sisters, Mona and Sana, have been tireless advocates for Ali and for prisoners in general. They've constantly challenged prison authorities, challenged the judicial system to fight for the rights of Ali and other prisoners. They've gone on hunger strikes, have done actions, they've raised awareness, they're constantly speaking out, and all of them have been arrested at different times for their activism. In 2014, both Ali and Sana were in prison at the same time, and their father, the prominent human rights lawyer Ahmed Saif, died of a heart condition while they were inside. Just this past March, Leila and Mona were arrested and released the next day after holding a small protest to call for the release of prisoners amid the coronavirus outbreak. And then as prison visitations were suspended, communication cut off, they stepped up their actions. And this kind of came to a head 2 weeks ago when Sana and Mona and Leila were physically assaulted after spending the night outside the prison, demanding that authorities allow them to receive a letter from Ali. Sana, in particular, was very badly beaten. And when they went to the public prosecutor's office the next day, Sana was forcibly taken by plainclothes security forces. Prosecutors later, a few hours later, ordered her to be imprisoned for 15 days in pretrial detention, an order that can be renewed for months or even years. And Sana, who's only 26, has already spent over a year and a half in prison in two separate cases. So now Sherif, both Ali and Sana are in prison at the same time. And I sat down with Leila Swaif a couple of days ago to talk about
so
all this.
So let's go to this interview, this first broadcast exclusive interview that you did with her since her daughter Sana's arrest.
Thank you for joining us, Leila Swaif. Your daughter Sana was arrested nearly 2 weeks ago. The prosecution ordered Sana to be held in pretrial detention for 15 days. Yes. Do you expect her to be getting out anytime soon?
I hope so. You can never tell. It's possible that they will just continue to renew her. But it is also possible that because of all the circumstances around her arrest, that it will not just go into this routine of just renewing. I think it really depends on how much of a headache we can create for the prosecutor. Maybe if we can create a large enough headache about the fact that this is a cover-up for a kidnap, maybe she will be released. I'm not sure.
Two of your three children, Sana and Ali, are now in prison. This has happened before in 2014. What's it like for you now that they're both once again locked up?
It hasn't sunk in that Sana is actually in prison. It's like like she went away for a while. I have to remember to walk her dog, feed her dog. I think I suppose it's going to be like before, except, okay, the first time was very tough because my husband was very sick, and he went into coma, and he died while they were in prison. It was really, really tough. And I think, I said about Sana a little while ago that she managed her imprisonment, but what really hit her was losing her father while she was in prison. That hit her. That hit her, and that has left scars that show to this day suddenly there are times when it just all comes out. And yes, hopefully nobody's going to die while in prison this time, hopefully. So let's hope, it won't be such a traumatic experience.
When's the last time you spoke to Ale?
Just a week before the lockdown. Like, it was 2 March, 3 March, something like that.
So about 4 months ago.
Yes.
Is that the longest time you haven't heard your son's voice?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And even when he was working in South Africa, I think we talked on the phone like once a week or something. I used to get these horrible bills.
Well, how's that experience that you can't hear his voice, that there's just communication through a letter once in a while?
With Ala in particular, it's very tough because Ala is the person I talk with. Ala is the person I talk with about science fiction novels and the stupidity of people who don't understand the probability and probabilistic dangers. And Ala is the person I talk with. So 4 months without talking to Ala, it's really...
You and your family have consistently been trying to put pressure on authorities. You've been arrested, you've been physically assaulted. Do you ever get afraid of the repercussions? I mean, what gives you strength to keep doing this?
I'm always afraid of the repercussions. Nobody can be cannot, particularly as the repercussions fall on other people. Maybe I'm not that afraid about, I'm 64, it doesn't matter what happens to me anymore anyway. But I'm certainly afraid of what can happen to my daughters. When we were arrested, I was afraid for Hadef and Rabab. I was afraid. But I think we can't even give up because Ala is in prison. And you can't decide, okay, I'm not going. I'm going to stop. How can I stop? Ala is in prison. And when I was out of prison, he was in this horrible muraqaba thing where he had to spend the night, every night in the police station, etc. And he's not. So you actually don't have an option. And the option of not doing anything is not there. This is not a regime which will allow, which will leave you alone if you're quiet. And I've learned during my life that if there's something where you don't have an option, you just do it the best way you can. This is long training. You translate things to actual actions. You don't think about, you don't sit down and think about the consequences. You don't sit down and think about the years that are flying by. You just translate it into practical tasks, and you finish the tasks. Like, I have to finish the dishes, I have to finish this petition, for Nabil Ayam, etc.
Your family has had long and difficult experience with prisons in Egypt, and two of your children are now in prison. How has all of this affected your family?
It's okay. It's put all, in a way, it's put all of our careers on hold. Munna should by now have done a PhD. She hasn't. I'm still a university professor, and I still teach, but I haven't managed to do research for years now. I mean, you sort of are forced into becoming a full-time human rights activist, which we actually are not. I mean, the only one who was a human rights lawyer was Saif, my husband, before he died. I'm a professor of mathematics. Saleh is a software developer. Mona is a biologist. Sana is a film editor. But you end up, you know, doing all this around your other things. Yeah.
So what are you calling for now?
Well, I'm okay. Mainly, I'm still calling for what I called for when I stood outside Majlis al-Wuzara and was arrested, that because of COVID-19, there should be massive releases of prisoners. This is the only way to make sure that there is not hundreds of prisoners who will be sick and maybe die and so on. And there are thousands, actually. So this is the initial demand. In the meantime, while this is not happening, prisons should not be locked down. There should be either the visits should be reopened, or at least there should be telephone calls, stuff like that. And finally, Taban, I'm demanding the release of Ale and Sana, because they are both on pre-trial detention, and these are only the urgent demands. We need the authorities to take COVID-19 seriously. We need authorities to spend money on hospitals, on doctors, on protecting doctors. We need the authorities to stop arresting doctors who talk about the problems of COVID-19, and many things.
Sana had said that she had lost hope for change. What about you? What gives you hope?
What is happening now, nightmarish as it is change. I have lived a very long time. I keep saying there is a very big difference between being part of a popular movement that is in retreat and that has been vanquished, and being part of a very small elitist movement, which is how things were from the 80s to 2011. For me, even this nightmarish situation is change. The fact that I get thousands of people talking about Aliyah, the fact that this is completely the fact that I get the fact that when we even when we talk about a very controversial issue like homophobia or whatever, we get thousands of supporters. None of this. I compare to the past. I compare this to the first time Saif took up a case, the Queen Boat case, a case about homosexuals. And nobody, and he had to fight with human rights lawyers. Okay? Now, no human rights lawyer would say, no, this shouldn't take this case. At that time, nobody would touch it. Almost nobody. I sincerely believe that part of the viciousness of this regime is the fact that it feels outstripped by events.
What do you mean?
everything. So many people are making jokes about them. So many people are, so many young people are doing things that nobody imagined before. So they're trying to curb all that viciously. Look at the doctors. Okay, they arrest the doctor because he's talked about corona. Next day, there is another doctor who's talking about condition. They are being very vicious, but actually they are not managing to control things. And I think that part of the viciousness is that. Okay, so there is a difference. There is a very, I can see it in young people. They are angry. They are not. They're put upon, but they are not accepting it lying down. But for me, a change has happened, and this change will have to bear fruit at some point.
But many people are disheartened and feel demoralized by what's happening now, both in Egypt and some places abroad as well. You seem to strike a more hopeful tone.
All these authorities who are disheartening us, like Sisi and like Trump, and like anyone can see that they are not going to get a stable system. Okay, and you can have an unstable system that goes on for a long time, but it's not. It's never. Anyone can see that it's never going to be a stable system. There are always chances in an unstable system. There are always chances. You might be able to make use of them, you might not, but there are always chances.
Are you following the mass protest movement against police violence in the U.S., and how does it resonate for you?
Sure. I've always thought, since 2011, I've always thought that what we have, what is being born, is an international movement against authoritarianism, against this kind of thing. There is a difference, but it's only a difference in quality, not in quantity, not in quality, between police in the States and police in Egypt and, I don't know, police in England. Police in France. These are the countries I know. I'm glad that people are rising. I'm hoping that I say every time I see people rise against authoritarianism, against police brutality, anywhere in the world, this gives me hope, because for me, this is a movement that has to happen all over the world.
That's Leila Swif, mathematics professor and mother of Alaa and Saneh. She was interviewed by Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous in Cairo, Egypt. An online petition has been launched at change.org calling on Egypt's attorney general to release prisoners being held in pretrial detention and to allow Alaa Abdel Fattah and other prisoners to communicate with their families, and for the release of Sanaa Seif. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Wear a mask.
Terrible and dreadful amongst the Eden, call upon his name in this time. It must be Jah. Yes, it must be Jah.
Hello, Capital Region. Welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. My name is Alexis Goldsmith, and I hope that you all had a safe holiday weekend. Up first today, Catherine Gallagher interviews activist Jeanne Finley on the Aref Hassan case, and then Aaron Blanding interviews Mylin Loco, an architectural scientist and building technology researcher at RPI. And later on, Peter Sergei speaks with drag queen and activist Moore Glamazon. After that, HMM producer Jared Wesley Singer talks with Dr. Sasha Wagner of the Water Justice Laboratory at RPI. And we'll close out the show by speaking live with Siobhan Burke of the Troy Sanctuary Campaign and Ice Free Capital District. All of that coming up. But first, here are some of today's headlines. Last year, Governor Cuomo said New York would enact new regulations to restrict and change the use of solitary confinement in state prisons. The Times Union reports that a year later, those new rules have not been finalized, though they were proposed last August. And legislation that would overhaul the state's use of solitary confinement, which has support from a majority of lawmakers in the legislature, the overhaul, that isn't expected to pass anytime soon. Albany County has seen an increase in positive coronavirus cases, and many were traced back to two restaurants where staff tested positive, county leaders said Saturday. Meanwhile, Wolf's Beer Garden has shut down all three of its locations in the Capital District since the owner felt that customers were not adequately practicing safe distancing. The Daily Gazette reports that two New Schenectady school board members and one re-elected incumbent started new three-year terms on July 1st, emphasizing the need to better engage and communicate with student families. All three of the new board members are women of color. Only one of the overall school board members are parents of a student, though, within the district. The Troy Record reports that Mayor Patrick Madden and the RENSCO Pandemic Response Committee have announced the return of Summer Square to downtown Troy during the months of July, August, and September. The Summer Square program will activate public streets, parks, alleyways, and parking spaces for outdoor dining, shopping, and community programming in downtown Troy and beyond. The Supreme Court ruled Monday that states can punish members of the Electoral College who break a pledge to vote for a state's popular vote winner in electoral elections. This vote came in a 9-0 ruling. The Electoral College gives undue weight to small states, particularly southern ones that embraced slavery. Reformers have been trying to get electoral delegates to agree to vote for whomever wins the electoral popular vote, which Clinton won by 3 million votes in 2016. A video posted by an Indiana resident over the weekend shows a group of five white men allegedly attempting to lynch a black man in Bloomington, Indiana. The video shows the young man, Vox Rush Booker, bent double as two unidentified white men pin him against a tree. Booker was visiting Lake Monroe with friends when the incident occurred. Booker said the men, who were intoxicated, followed the group while shouting racial slurs and said that the young people were trespassing, though they were in a public park. Throughout the incident, the men beat Booker and stood on his neck. Booker's friends, who are white, attempted to push the attackers away, shouting, "Let him go," quote, and quote, "We're just trying to get out of here." One of the assailants then slapped the phone away. Booker was eventually able to escape. The Indiana DNR confirmed that the, quote, "officers responded to a call for service," end quote, though their response has been met with heavy criticism. A series of suspected lynchings have occurred across the U.S. and in South Africa since the Black Lives Matter movement erupted just over a month ago, though all have been ruled suicides by officials. On Monday, the New York State Department of Health released a report on the factors associated with nursing home infections and fatalities in New York State during the COVID-19 global health crisis. In a news conference on Monday, New York State Health Commissioner Dr. Howard Zucker said the report found COVID-19 deaths in New York's nursing homes were most likely caused by asymptomatic infected staff than by patients readmitted from hospitals based on antibody testing and peak death rates of specific populations. Health Commissioner Zucker noted that unproven narratives can sometimes be accepted if issued with repetition, likely responding to critics of Governor Cuomo's directive issued on March 25th that required nursing homes to accept residents back from hospitals after they had recovered from COVID-19. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and we're broadcasting from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And up first on tonight's program, Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Catherine Gallagher speaks with activist Jan Finley on the Aref Hussan case. The case spanned 15 years, involved an FBI sting operation, and countless acts of activism to keep the public's eye on the injustices. This is part one of a two-part interview.
Hi, I'm Catherine Gallagher here with Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm joined here today with Jean Finley, who has worked on the Aref Hussan case as an activist for the past 15 years. So Jean, first of all, what was the Aref Hussan case?
It was a case of what we later termed preemptive prosecution of two local Muslim men who were arrested in 2004 in a fictional FBI sting, which targeted both of them, but more specifically Yassin Aref, who was the imam at the Masjid As-Salam on Central Avenue in Albany. It was a terrorism prosecution. It was a sting in so far as there was a government-paid informant who was coached to make up a fictional plot and scenario and try to get the two men to agree to it, which they never did. But they were arrested. It involved money laundering, supposedly to take out the Pakistani ambassador in New York City. None of this was real. None of it was true. And at no time did either of the men agree to do anything even remotely connected to terrorism. But unfortunately, they were convicted by a jury who was actually afraid to acquit. Remember, that was just post 9/11. There was a huge amount of anti-Muslim sentiment at the time and fear, and the jury was afraid to acquit. Well, what if they really were terrorists? They were convicted in 2006. They were sentenced to 15 years each in federal prison, and it got really international attention in little old Albany, New York. 5 days after their conviction in October of 2006, two very strong activists, Kathy Cowan and May Safar, a Muslim woman and a peace activist, started the Muslim Solidarity Committee, which was specifically generated to advocate for the men to help their families. Between the two families, there were 10 young children, and we kind of went on from there. Out of that, very shortly thereafterwards, came a fundraising effort for those families because they were left with nothing. The male wage earners were gone, and we just started off that way with other activists, members of the Muslim community, and other people from surrounding areas saying this was an absolute travesty of justice. We couldn't believe that it happened, or that it happened here in our community, which had always been pretty well open to a huge diversity of people. Immigrants, Muslims, refugees, African American, minorities, and in some cases majorities. So a very diverse community, which Albany still is today. Also, we were very happy in that independently, the area newspapers seemed to have a great deal of trouble understanding how this could have happened and understood that it was indeed a travesty of justice. So we had the support of the newspapers as well, which was nice. And we did work for that, but of course, a newspaper is independent. You can't always rely on that, but they were thinking the same as we were thinking. So from October 2006, which is when our efforts began, we went forward over the years, and the case became a cause célèbre for a lot of different issues that would ultimately surface on a national scale, such as secret evidence, illegal secret wiretapping, which was absolutely used in this case. And to this day, that evidence has never been not only made public, but never was available to the defense, because that was, of course, huge national security. So the use of secret evidence, the use of stings, the use of paid government informants who certainly had a key motivation to succeed, which was money. You know, a whole lot of other issues that then would come to the fore in other very similar cases around the country, of which there were hundreds. We were shocked to see, as time went on, how many other cases there were, all of Muslims. You know, that some of these issues have never been resolved and are still in front of us today. So it was kind of a microcosm of where America was right post 9/11, and over the years how America has evolved, sometimes in a good way and a great many times not in a good way.
Wow. It's such an interesting, such a case with so many twists and turns, and to think that it happened in Albany is just crazy. So what happened to Yasin Arif and Muhammad Hussein?
To compress the 15 years, give you the best news first, both men are now free and they're home with their families. Yasin was finished with his sentence in October of 2018. And then because he was not a citizen, he was sent to ICE detention, which is what the government does with anyone with a major crime conviction, you know, as a prelude to deportation. Yasin had requested voluntary deportation the minute he was finished with his sentence and was moved into ICE detention. He wanted to go home. He's an Iraqi Kurd. His family lives in Kurdistan in the northern part of Iraq, and he did not want to stay in this country, and so he requested voluntary deportation. So it was not a sad thing that the government was looking to deport him. Indeed, he wanted to go as soon as possible. But of course, the government delayed the deportation because of, you know, many different reasons, not all of which had to do with him or his conviction. It was just the general policy of the government at the time. Iraq was in the middle of one of its episodic periods of chaos, and so it became impossible to deport him because the airports were closed. Regardless, he was finally, with about a day and a half notice, told to pack up his things and get on a plane, and which he finally did, and got off the plane on June 9th back to his family in Kurdistan, where he has been living since then. Muhammad Hussein was just very recently finally released, and that again was a very large fight to get him released a little bit early. His sentence was up in July this month of 2020. But because of the coronavirus spreading throughout the federal prison system, and because his health and his age dictated that he should be top of the list to be released, his lawyer put in a compassionate release request. This is quite a large undertaking. You'd think it would be easy. It is not easy, and it takes a long time, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons has no policy for this, and so he was told he was going home, and then he was told he wasn't going home, and of course in there you have to quarantine. So we did a petition to the judge. Actually, it was a judge's order that freed him, and it turned out that, of course, it was the original trial judge who heard the entire trial in 2006, who sentenced the men. That's who it had to go back to. We did a petition. There was a lot of concerted legal work. The public defender wrote a great amount of why he should be released, and it all worked. And Muhammad Hussein came home. Well, he was released on June 8th, just this past month. On June 16th, we held a very informal but very warm and loving welcome home street party for him here in Albany. So that's what's happened to the men, and that's what's happened to their families. They're all reunited, and it seems to be the end. But of course, it's not the end. The issues that exist around this case and hundreds of other cases throughout the country, and now, of course, the threat of coronavirus in federal prisons, which is decimating the prisons, are requiring flurry of compassionate release petitions, you know, which will bring someone home, or home confinement, you know, electronic bracelet, etc. But they're home, they're out of prison where they would be front and center to be able to catch the coronavirus.
That was part one of a two-part interview with Jean Finley, who has been working as an advocate on the Arif Hussein case in the Capital District and beyond, and part two will be about the outcomes and effects that this trial has had.
Stay tuned for part two of this segment. It will be airing on Tuesday and Wednesday morning, and you can hear both of these segments online at mediasanctuary.org. Up next, a new radio/podcast series interviews researchers and scientists of color from a variety of disciplines about the importance of their work and how systems of inequity have impacted their fields through a lens of social and environmental justice, especially considering the racial justice movement happening today. This interview by Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Aaron Blanding features Myling Loco, an architectural scientist and building technology researcher at RPI.
This is Aaron Blanding, and I'm here with Myling Loco for People Science. And I just want to say thanks so much for interviewing with me.
I'm super glad to be here.
Awesome. So my first question is, if you could please discuss your research and your work and what impact your research has on your field.
Sure. So, you know, my work focuses, you know, on taking some of the world's most underutilized resources in the form of waste from agriculture and the food sector, and upcycling them into a variety of sustainable material building systems. In terms of its impact, or I'd hope that it has this sort of impact, I think it's addressing, you know, the building sector's, you know, most challenging problems in terms of energy use, material use. We primarily rely on a very high embodied and mechanical paradigm of systems to not only construct but maintain our buildings over the course of their lives. And to a large extent, in response to depleting, you know, material resources, climate change, affordability, you know, there's an opportunity to look elsewhere, and in the process of doing so, create some really cool products and hopefully a range of new green collar jobs.
Awesome. That's really awesome to hear about and exciting to, you know, watch. So I'm sure you're aware of everything that's happening right now, which I think is pretty exciting. And so I was wondering what impact has, you know, the pandemic and the current Black Lives Matter movement had on you and your research?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit that, you know, before, you know, there's silver lining, there's a lot of somberness in terms of the impacts of this health crisis and this sort of racialized system that we are part of in terms of our communities, in terms of, you know, much larger systems, governmental systems, or academic institutions. But I think, you know, COVID in particular has made me much more hyper-focused on the local. And you know, just in terms of where and who is involved in the sourcing and, you know, processing and distribution of such technologies, and how to really rethink how value is circulated within that local community, because I think that constitutes, you know, a form of resilience in times like this. And, you know, sort of trying to think of, you know, the built environment as not just a place we inhabit, but as a form of public health infrastructure. And in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, you know, of course that's, you know, sort of propelling conversations and hopefully change in a few ways. I think a lot of people have been talking about the structural stuff, you know, in terms of how do we get more people who are from Black or minority communities participating and participating productively in all aspects of our society. But I think what is less being discussed is, particularly in universities, is the intrinsic stuff. So, you know, what are our curricula? What are our knowledge systems that is being taught, speaking to, you know, in terms of students? Is it actually engaging students of color, Black students, in a way that is really critical, that allows them to find their own voice, their own agency, in a world that is very slow changing, right? So I think there's some excitement in terms of the energy that I think this moment in time has catalyzed. But it is also a somber moment to realize, you know, these are the same issues we've been talking about for decades and centuries. And, you know, if this is going to truly be different, you know, what are we each individually doing to contribute to that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, as an African-American student myself, I've noticed that a lot of my curriculum isn't really geared towards me. And so I think that that's a pretty important conversation we need to have. It's not just, you know, building names and street murals. It's more intrinsic, like you said. So that's really awesome. As an engineer, in today's society, you know, like you said, we're facing a lot of the same issues that we've been dealing with before. And I wanted to ask, what do you think is the first step in making STEM more welcoming to people of color?
I mean, I think, you know, I think we both can identify that we form a minority in STEM fields, and also when we go out into the professional world. In terms of making it more welcome, again, I think there's stuff obviously that's systemic in terms of, you know, financial aid that is linked to a much wider, you know, systemic issue. And then there's also, you know, things like representation, seeing mentors, and finding a community within schools that is, you know, welcoming and fosters, you know, dialogue that is bi-directional, you know. I think it goes back, you know, to the curricula. How can academia redesign, you know, curricula, tools, it's the relationship of these things that we learn in our classrooms to the types of problems and experiences that, you know, students of color, Black students are familiar with. And so I think we need to get much more creative about that. And I think, yes, there's some conversations happening, but those questions need to very quickly, you know, jump to some experimentations, because I think there's going to be a long period of experimentation in order to really evolve some really powerful ways of, you know, engaging and sustaining the types of communities, STEM communities, that people of color will feel comfortable and, you know, incredibly productive within.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree. It needs to happen soon, and the conversation needs to be had. So what advice can you give for young people of color navigating STEM?
Well, you know, I think STEM forms one part of the work I do. And I think, you know, first of all, I think of course there's a high demand for STEM, you know, disciplines and STEM skills. Mm-hmm. But trying to see the bigger picture in terms of other areas of knowledge that can also contribute to synergistic STEM goals. I've always found that, being curious has been such a wonderful catalyst for, you know, students particularly students of color, when they have, you know, they engage more fruitfully with STEM education. And, you know, I think there are tons of frontiers unexplored within STEM disciplines. Between them and also with surrounding disciplines like STEAM disciplines. And so, you know, I think being an outsider to the types of, you know, STEM institutions that we are a part of, you know, simply by, you know, the fact that we're minorities might be uncomfortable, but it is also a superpower. It gives you a unique set of experiences and skills and persistence that is really needed across a much longer lifetime of learning and leading. And I think that's ultimately what an education is about. So yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity for students of color to chart these types of territories, you know, primarily because of their experiences and the worldviews that they bring into you know, our schools and in our workplaces.
Thanks so much for that. This is Erin Blanding, and I've interviewed Mei-Ling Loco for People Science, and I appreciate you tuning in.
Again, that was HMM producer Erin Blanding interviewing Mei-Ling Loco, an architectural scientist and building technology researcher at RPI. This is the first episode in the new People Science podcast series. And if you're just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Again, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about this program, to listen online, and to learn about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments and suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Up next, HMM Arts correspondent Peter Sergey interviews Maura Glamazon. At the Schenectady Black Lives Matter Pride protest on Saturday, July 4th, they discuss her role emceeing the event, drag performance during COVID-19, and the many ways to aid the Black Lives Matter movement.
This is Peter Sergey, arts correspondent with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and today I'm joined by Maura Glamazon, a local drag queen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So where are we?
We are at Schenectady Pride Black Lives Matter March. It was amazing.
And what have you been doing today?
What have I been doing? I have been emceeing, trying to keep the energy up for people, trying to make sure that everyone's voice is heard, not just mine, but everyone, because all our voices matter, and it's all our voices together that's going to make a difference.
Who were some of the speakers who were here today that you emceed for?
I emceed for a lot of poetry. We have a lot of spoken word. Adontis, Shayla, Michaela. Michaela's amazing. She's actually one of the organizers of All of Us, which is the foundation that brought all of us together, ironically enough. I have been so blessed to be able to work with these people. They came into my life about 2 months ago, and ever since, it's been nothing but amazing.
So, when did you start being a drag queen, and how did you get into drag?
Okay, all right, you want the first one, or the, no, I'm joking. Okay, so how I got into drag is I actually was starting a web series about kind of like gay life, gay culture, things that the LGBTQIA people go through via interview and personal experience, but also I wanted to experience different parts of our culture. So about a year and a half ago, I messaged Cece LaRue and was like, hey girl, I got a show. Can I do drag? Can I like come do that? I want to try. And she was like, absolutely. Come on down, come to Wacky Wednesday, and we're going to do that. And ever since, like, I've been bit. Like, I loved it. I did it one time, it went great. I did it a second time, and they said, make sure you keep coming back. And I said, absolutely. And ever since, I've just been getting better and better. And I found a drag mother, Calypso Breeze, who is training me how to become the beautiful woman that you see here before you. but not melted, because it's not usually not 90 degrees in a bar or a library or wherever I'm performing.
How has your work with drag been affected by COVID-19?
My work with drag has definitely been affected because you're doing online shows. It's a different type of performance because usually you have energy to feed off of. You have the bar, you have the audience, you have the whatever audience is there to feed off of that energy. On an online show, it's really, if it's live, it's you, and if it's, you don't know if it's going well. You can't tell. If I need to adjust something, I don't know. When people are in front of me, if I need to adjust something, I can do it automatically and I will get a reaction from the audience. Yeah. And so that's definitely one of the biggest barriers for me, is that I feed off of energy. So not having the physical people there to interact with is definitely really hard. For me, COVID-19 affected how much I perform. I definitely took a step back, and then I stepped so hard into this movement of Black Lives Matter that I haven't touched drag for about 3 months. So this is the first time in 3 months that I've been in drag since stepping so hard into this movement, because it's something I've always believed in. But the organization All of Us has made it so attainable for me to become an activist and learn what good activism is. Yeah.
And your work with drag, funnily enough, is beneficial to the movement. Like, you're doing drag for Black Lives Matter.
Exactly. Since you guys will not probably see this dress, I'm literally in a beautiful gown with a huge train that is sheer, and down the side says Black Lives Matter. I don't think my art could speak any louder. And I think for me, it's definitely, I'm always about making a statement. I'm going to school to work with the youth. I'm going to school to make different things attainable for children, to show them that you can come from nothing, because I come from nothing, and you can be something at the end of it. I think around throughout the Capital Region, we have a lot of beautiful voices that are trying to do that same thing and empower the youth. So I think if I can do art and touch someone and make them feel like they matter, or that, and make them feel something, that then I've done my job for that day. If it's one person, it's one person. If it's 3,000 people, it's 3,000 people. I don't care. As long as I've made someone feel good, I'm doing my job, because that's the reason that I started. I'll never forget one year, I think it was like 3 years ago, at Waterworks, there's a drag queen, her name's Kashi Goleen. She performed a Jess Glynn song, and I started crying. I wasn't drunk. I was at Waterworks. I wasn't drunk. But I started crying because the performance was so beautiful. And I was like, maybe I could do that. And it took a good 2 years for me to like muster it up to try it. But she made a difference, and she didn't even know she made a difference for me that day. And she was just performing, living in her truth, and it was amazing.
Yeah. So you said you work with children, like you work with kids. Could you tell me more about that?
In my past, I've been a nanny. I've been a camp counselor. I've run a camp. I'm actually, hey, Ricky, come here. Come here. I'm actually helping Ricky. Ricky works a lot with youth. He's starting a foundation for the kids in the Capital Region. So this is the most recent project that I have been a privy to, and he is amazing.
Hi, Ricky. What's
your phone? Oh, sorry. I just told you. I'm like, you're right here. Perfect. Because I'm about to talk about you. This is for, I'm sorry, what paper is the, what?
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Sanctuary for Independent Media.
There you go.
Okay.
But he's an amazing person that I have gotten blessed to know through drag and through Waterworks, among other places.
So we're almost out of time, but is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know today?
There is not one way to make a difference in this movement. There's different avenues for everyone to make a difference. If you want to make a difference via the internet, via creating art, via dancing, there is a way to make an impact. If your impact is, I love shopping and I'm a shopping addict and I just want to buy black from now on, buy black from now on. You can make your impact in so many different ways. You don't have to come out here, but I do tell everyone, we have to take up space. And when I say take up space on all avenues. Like I said, shopping, dancing, art, make sure you're doing so much, okay? If you have an idea, run with it, all right? Run with it until someone's like, but even at that moment, keep running, because you don't know, they might not know. Let's keep going. Just keep going forward, all right? And don't look back.
Well, thank you, More Glamazon, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you just heard correspondent Peter Sergey in a conversation with drag queen and activist More Glamazon from the Schenectady Black Lives Matter Pride protest on Saturday, July 4th. Up next, Dr. Sasha Wagner, assistant professor of earth and environmental science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, is interviewed by Jared Wesley Singer of the Water Justice Laboratory. Sasha studies the role of dissolved organic matter in soils, rivers, and oceans. The dissolved organic matter is an important link between life on land and aquatic ecosystems.
I'm Jared Wesley Singer with the Water Justice Laboratory, and I'm here today with Professor Sasha Wagner, who studies dissolved organic matter. Thanks for joining me, Professor Wagner.
Thanks for having me, Jared. I'm really excited to be here and talk about my work and how it relates to the things that you've been working on.
Can you please introduce yourself and give a overview of dissolved organic matter in small streams and big rivers?
Sure. So I'm a relatively new assistant professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in the Earth and Environmental Sciences Department. And my research is quite broad, and it pretty much broadly focuses on the biogeochemistry of dissolved organic matter in a variety of different aquatic systems. So this ranges from small headwater streams, like small ones that you can jump across easily through estuaries, all the way out to the open ocean. It's a really broad area that I study, but kind of focusing on the same thing, dissolved organic matter, and we call it DOM for short. All of us have encountered it in our daily lives, particularly if you are near a waterway. So DOM, or dissolved organic matter, is really it's a complex mixture of millions and millions of soluble organic molecules. Really, this is what gives water its color. So if you look at a river and you see it slightly brown or slightly green, then that's DOM that's giving it its color. And the DOM that's in there comes from both natural sources, so living organisms. If you have algae that are proliferating in the water, they can release some dissolved organic matter, but also a detrital material. So this includes things like soil or decaying leaves on the landscape. DOM can also come from anthropogenic, so human-derived sources like agricultural runoff or wastewater or other synthetic materials. This is all included within the bubble or the sphere of DOM. Dissolved organic matter is mobilized by water. As you can imagine, it's dissolved, it's in water. And this occurs during rainfall events, or if you live in an area that's snowy, like here in upstate New York, snowmelt plays a big role in mobilizing dissolved organic matter. These dissolved organics are really important in connecting land to aquatic systems because it's flowing between these two reservoirs. And so to just talk a little bit about how these processes might be different in small streams and big rivers, or just processes that affect dissolved organic matter in general. When you're talking about small streams, the dissolved organic matter in these waterways are typically produced locally. So whatever is leaves falling from the trees, the soils that are in the zones that are right next to the stream, the DOM is usually from that local area. Whereas much larger rivers, so the main stem of the Hudson, for example, integrates these catchment-wide dissolved organic matter inputs. So you can imagine all these tributaries coming together. There's a variety of different dissolved organic matter sources, and they're being reworked within the river network as it flows from the headwaters to the mouth. The way it's reworked, it includes a variety of different biogeochemical processes. So some of these processes include being broken down by sunlight. So if it's exposed to sunlight, you can change the chemistry of dissolved organic matter, or biodegradations. Microbes can chew on these dissolved organic matter molecules. All these different sources and processes that are acting on the DOM pool, collectively, these DOM molecules tell a story about the water's history and overall catchment health. And this is really similar to when you go to the doctor, you have a blood sample collected and they do a variety of different tests on them. And then it gives you an indication of what your human health is, like how healthy are you? And so we do the same thing with DOM in rivers. Because it's roughly made up of roughly 50% carbon, it's a huge global carbon store. And so a lot of my research is devoted to studying particularly that last point, determining the role that DOM plays in both regional and global carbon cycles.
Yeah, wow. That is a lot that's interconnected. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate how human activities may specifically influence dissolved organic matter?
Really any kind of development that alters our quote-unquote natural landscapes. There's very few landscapes that are natural anymore, but any development that alters existing or these more natural landscapes can change the composition of river DOM, essentially. So we can look at a few obvious examples, and this includes things like urbanization, so the growing of cities and but then also agriculture. So for example, converting forested landscapes to agricultural landscape, both of these processes, both urbanization and agricultural development, can actually increase, for example, the amount of organic nitrogen, sulfur and phosphorus in streams. So you're releasing a lot more nutrients when you're making these changes to the landscape, but also less obvious things like building dams or draining wetlands can also dramatically alter the clarity and color of river water, which pushed out from the landscape to these river systems.
You were talking about how dissolved organic matter can be like a bill of health for a waterway.
Yeah.
What are the characteristics of a healthy waterway?
Something that's important to remember is that all river systems, even in their natural state, are going to vary. There's going to be some variation. So the Colorado River, which drains very arid regions out west, is going to be really different in its natural state than, say, you know, the Hudson River was before it was developed by humans. Having lower nutrient concentrations is generally an indicator that a river is healthy, because what happens is if you end up releasing a lot of sulfur, nitrogen, and phosphorus collectively, we just kind of call these nutrients, because these elements are what microbes need to grow and survive and to thrive. And so what happens is if you end up putting in, let's say, wastewater treatment plants or converting forested landscapes to agriculture, and then you apply fertilizer, you're going to have a lot more nutrients running off. And so these microbial communities, such as algae and things, can bloom and become problematic, because they in and of themselves can release toxins and other harmful molecules, but then also they have other lingering ecological effects. For example, when these algae bloom because of these nutrient inputs, they end up kind of sucking all of the oxygen out of the water, because they need the oxygen in addition to the nutrients to do their work, to synthesize more organic material and to grow. So what that does is that takes away all the oxygen from the other organisms living in the water, like fish, and so you can have fish dying off.
The Riverkeeper Network of Labs has been measuring Enterococcus bacteria in the Hudson River as a proxy for fecal matter entering the Hudson River through combined sewage overflow events. And that's where a rainfall event will overflow the sewer system and put raw sewage directly into the waterways. Could you comment at all about how these kinds of CSO events might affect dissolved organic matter in the river systems?
Actually, done some research in the past that has looked at dissolved organic matter characteristics in a variety of different watersheds, and there is absolutely very specific signatures that come from wastewater, so I would expect these CSOs as well. From a DOM perspective, I would expect these CSOs to have an immediate impact on water quality. These are also point sources of pollution. And again, getting back to, you know, linking these anthropogenic type inputs to DOM quality, typically CSOs or other sort of direct inputs of sewage, you tend to have not only the nutrients that we've talked about a bit already, things like sulfur and phosphorus and nitrogen that just come from human waste or other animal waste. There's a lot of enrichment in nutrients in these waste products. But also, as I mentioned before, dissolved organic matter is made up of a mixture of many, many different, you know, millions of individual molecules. And there are certain types of molecules that come specifically from these wastewater treatment plants, and they give off a certain signature, which you can track using a variety of different analytical techniques. They can be molecular techniques or optical technique. Essentially, in a very basic sense, you shine a light on your sample, and based on how the light interacts with the DOM, you can get a feel for what kind of chemistry is going on in there. So these CSO waste products that are entering rivers can have this specific signature, and then therefore you can sort of infer that they're going to have some issues or create some ecological issues.
Is there any other very important aspect of dissolved organic matter that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, there's a lot of other aspects aside from anthropogenic development that can impact dissolved organic matter in rivers and other waterways. So even in relatively pristine environments, rainfall runoff processes have really emerged as these key controllers of DOM in rivers. And I think that this also links into what has been observed for CSOs, which during these high flow events, like during rainfall, you have this raw sewage plus rainwater entering these pipes at the same time and being flushed out temporally, meaning, you know, at a very specific point in time, these the CSO effluent becomes a real problem. But also during these storm events, you can have a lot of natural DOM being exported from the watershed. This rainwater infiltrates the soils and the landscapes, and then you end up having concentrations of DOM increase because you have a lot more interaction with the water and then all this detrital material that DOM comes from. And so water velocities are also increased during these hydrologic events. And so there's a lot of soils and other sediments that can be picked up and carried further downstream. Kind of taken together, when you have these storm events, you not only have high river discharge, but the river is carrying a lot more DOM. And then it also has higher turbidity or cloudiness levels. And so there could be a lot of sediment material, soil material, bacteria, other microorganisms that may have settled out during drier periods. It's a fun area to work in. I essentially chase these storm events within rivers. Having done a little bit of research in this area, it's pretty logistically challenging to go out and kind of chase storms and collect these samples by hand in non-ideal conditions. There's been a lot of work and a lot of future work that I think needs to be focused on in collecting higher resolutions data in stream. So we have these sensors that you can kind of stick in the water, and it can measure data points every 15 minutes. And so you can really capture a lot of these really dynamic events. It's a rapidly growing area of research that I'm particularly interested in.
Thanks, Sasha. If we at the Water Justice Lab can help you do any sampling of these dynamic storm events, we're happy to help.
Of course, that would be wonderful.
That was HMM producer Jared Wesley Singer talking with Dr. Sasha Wagner. To learn more about Sasha's work, check out her laboratory website at www.swagnerlab.com. That's SWAGNERLAB. And now, Siobhan Burke is a volunteer and activist with the Troy Sanctuary Campaign and coordinating committee member of Ice Free Capital District. She joins us live by phone to discuss how these groups have been working to help families in the region. Welcome, Siobhan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Can you give us an update on the Troy Sanctuary Campaign and Ice Free Capital District?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started off a few years ago as a volunteer effort, and we are still going strong. In Troy particularly, we are focusing on reaching out in the community, building relationships with local immigrant families who are impacted by enforcement, by ICE, working on building a base of support. And, as some of your listeners may know, we focused over the last couple of years on some local policy initiatives. And presently, a lot of our focus is more so in the direct aid phase. Right now, we're focusing on that relationship building and community organizing.
So I don't want to put you on the spot, Siobhan, because we didn't discuss this question ahead of time, but how are you able to safely identify families that need assistance without, putting them in the crosshairs of ICE?
I mean, that's kind of the most important question, right? We try to be as careful as we can with using secure channels of communication. What will sometimes happen is, folks will initially become aware of our work through word of mouth, and so they'll be referred to us by, individuals who are familiar with their situation. Sometimes, of course, people just find us online and reach out to us on Facebook Messenger or channels like that aren't as secure, and then we'll have them move over to an encrypted conversation in Signal, for example. We try to be as careful as we can with folks' information.
So can you talk about the fundraising and direct aid work you've been doing with the local families?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So the Troy Sanctuary Campaign has a fundraising and direct aid work group that has been working over the last couple years to raise funds for folks that are directly impacted by immigration enforcement, and also to provide some direct services. For example, we'll do grocery deliveries for some folks, We've helped folks find access to legal representation and medical care. Sometimes we help out with, you know, finding child care and, you know, basically whatever it is that a family is looking for, we'll reach out to our network and try to get it taken care of. And we're actually right now in the midst of doing some fundraising. We've got a GoFundMe up that's raising money specifically for 6 families in the Capital District, but also working on, you know, developing a little bit of an emergency fund as well. We're holding on to 10% of the funds raised so that as new requests for help come in, we'll be able to address those in real time.
So 10% of the funds are going to the emergency fund. Where are the rest of the funds going?
Mm-hmm. Well, the rest of them are going directly to these 6 families. And folks can find the GoFundMe on the Troy Sanctuary Campaign's Facebook page, as well as the ICE Free Capital District Facebook page. So basically, in terms of like the money that's coming in right now, the first $10,890 is going to be going straight to the impacted families. And then that extra, like the 10%, of course, is also going to go to impacted families, but it's for folks that we may not have heard from yet that might reach out in the next couple months. And we do these appeals typically once a quarter, and occasionally there will be like a really dire emergency that will require us to put out an additional special appeal, but typically we try to do it once every few months.
So this is an all-volunteer effort?
That's right. Yeah, we, you know, basically just started off as a few concerned friends, you know, who were following what was happening in the news. Some of us have had personal experience with immigration or with family members who were undocumented. And so in the aftermath of the 2016 election, I think local awareness started to spike around this issue. And so a lot of people had interest in providing support. And that's where this effort, you know, kind of sprang from. And at this point, I would say we have about 10 active volunteers and a few dozen more folks that are just sort of like on call if we need them to help with things like transportation. And beyond that, of course, we've got hundreds of folks that have given financially that are sharing our efforts online. And again, it's all 100% volunteer driven.
So as you're interacting with these families, you know, especially with the ride sharing, how are you able to continue direct aid while staying safe during COVID?
Yeah, it has definitely taken some work for us to like change some of our usual practices in the last few months. Of course, we've shifted a lot of our communications just to electronic methods. We rely on encrypted channels like Signal a lot. When we do like deliveries of groceries and other items, it's usually like a no contact method. And then in those occasions where folks do need to do like transportation assistance, it's a matter of like prioritizing everybody's safety by wearing masks and taking whatever, you know, the individual measures that need to be taken kind of vary for each family, depending on risk levels. But we do try to utilize some basic social distancing measures and keep everybody safe.
So Troy, being in Rensselaer County, everybody pretty well aware that the sheriff's department participates in 287G. Do you ever fear that, you know, you could be approached by ICE or Have you had any incidents with Immigrations and Customs Enforcement while doing this work?
Our volunteers haven't had those kind of interactions. It's certainly something that we think about and work to avoid, having that kind of direct interaction with law enforcement. So far, the protective measures that we've taken have been adequate, and we've managed to avoid that.
Excuse me. So, I'm sorry, could you share the GoFundMe page again? And how else can people, you know, get in contact with you if they want to get involved and help out?
Yeah, thank you. So, if folks go to GoFundMe.com and search for Solidarity Fund for Local Immigrant Families, you'll see our fundraiser. And you can also find it on Facebook, if you go to the Troy Sanctuary Campaign Facebook page or ICE Free Capital District on Facebook. And if folks want to reach out either with questions about how to donate or because they would like to volunteer, they can reach us at troysanctuarycampaign@gmail.com. They can also reach us at 518-389-8789. You can reach us there on Signal. And, you know, we are happy to hear from anyone that thinks that they may be able to help. Often, you know, financial support is what gets focused on, but we've also been able to bring a lot of folks into, you know, being able to support their immigrant neighbors through other kinds of direct support. So whatever you have that you think you might be able to offer, get in touch with us and hopefully we'll be able to work together.
And before we go, Siobhan, could I just ask, you know, why you personally feel that it's important to support our immigrant and undocumented neighbors?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Well, in terms of the personal perspective, my father was undocumented for about 12 years when he first came to this country. And so I have some personal experience with those issues that is what brought me to this. Of course, he was of European descent and had a lot of privilege that a lot of folks today don't have access to if they're people of color who are immigrating to this country. And I think that is that sort of imbalance, that inherent racism in our immigration policies is why it's important for folks to get involved right now at a personal level, because it, you know, even under previous administrations, but especially under this current Trump administration, undocumented immigrants are being villainized and stigmatized in a way that I think is incredibly dangerous. And the fact is, the vast majority of immigrants are, you know, whether they're documented or not, are less likely to commit crimes. They're, you know, just good people that are trying to make better lives for their families, and we all have an opportunity to stand in solidarity with them and to speak out against the unfair discrimination they're being exposed to. And I think that a lot of folks see these issues as like larger than life and things that they can't really express themselves about other than like maybe at a political rally or something. But the fact is, there are a lot of relationships we can build in our communities that make incredible differences, not just personally, but also politically. And so that's what we're trying to provide as an opportunity for folks to do that.
This has been Siobhan Burke, a volunteer and activist with Troy Sanctuary Campaign and ICE Free Capital District. Thank you so much for joining us, Siobhan.
Thank you, Alexis. I really appreciate it.
And if you are listening, If you go to mediasanctuary.org and our Facebook page, facebook.com/mediasanctuary, after this show, we will add all of the contact information that Siobhan listed in the description of this podcast. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Again, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. And if you have comments, suggestions, or want to tell us about how we're doing, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by amazing local volunteers working remotely. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, email us at info@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.
Black Lives Matter.
Hi, I'm Chris Matthews. I'm a social justice singer-songwriter based in the D.C. area. You are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
They say that freedom is a constant crying. They say that freedom is a constant crying. They say that.
Mm-hmm.